Me, which raises many questions, on top of which is, why is Egypt airdropping food aid when they can open the borders and let in thousands of trucks per day? Gazans took to social media to vent their frustration at the humiliating manner in which they were treated by the countries that dropped such aid. It is only reasonable for them to be angered by this humiliating act after they lived the horror of the night before, now forever known as the Flower Massacre. The massacre that began on Thursday, February 29, with the journey of hundreds of thousands of men, elderly, women, and young girls who walked towards the Nablus intersection located on Rashid Street, west of Gaza City, where the entrance gate for aid trucks from the south of the strip to the north is located. There, hundreds of thousands of hungry people gathered throughout the night, hoping to get one bag of flour. In the early hours of dawn, as the first aid trucks began to enter, an Israeli tank advanced with them, opening fire with machine guns and shells towards the thousands who crowded around the first truck. At the same time, other armored vehicles advanced, their identity concealed by the intense darkness, and began to run over and crush the crowd of people. In the sky, quadcopter drones flew, releasing heavy gunfire for hours, turning aid into bait to kill even more Palestinians who were not yet killed by genocide or starvation. This is the Middle East Stream, and I'm Marwa Osman. The Zionist enemy continues its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip for the 150th consecutive day. Last week, it carried out the horrific flower massacre on Rashid Street, southwest of Gaza City, targeting isolated civilians awaiting the arrival of aid and flour. The toll rose to more than 360 martyrs and wounded. In conjunction with the enemy's massacres and crimes, it continued to broadcast lies and false claims about what happened. The United States, which with its green light that it gave to the Zionist entity and endless support for the aggression, described the incident as serious and awaited reports on it. To discuss this issue with us from Madrid is Mr. Chema Sanchez, leader of the anti-imperialistas.com group, member of Red Network for the Defense of Humanity, and also self-proclaimed anti-imperialist militant. Thank you very much for being with us, Chema. Now, according to various estimates, there are around a quarter of a million people in the northern part of the Gaza Strip who are moving between destroyed houses and public buildings in an attempt to find something to eat, something to help their families with some safe shelter that could protect them. Jordan and Egypt, on the other hand, they did some drop for aids, whether food or any medical aid for that matter, via parachutes, which ended up killing more than 360 Palestinian and wounding others by direct Zionist fire, whether for the trucks or for the parachutes that were landing. Was this an attempt to help the Palestinians for real in the northern part of Gaza, or was it a bait to maybe lure in the physically capable men in northern Gaza to simply kill them because these men are capable of protecting their families in the face of Zionist Israel and in the face of any future Zionist reoccupation of the Gaza Strip?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to this anti-imperialist trench. Certainly any maneuver that even helps or brings closer to the hungry and besieged people will be taken by the Zionists as an opportunity to increase the attacks and their crimes and their genocide of the people, on the people of Gaza. But it is also a formula for laundering, for whitewashing crimes by pretending to be willing to provide aid that had a much simpler, and more rational formula, such as passing the aid without restrictions through the land border of Egypt, but without the intervention of the Israeli siege. Therefore, it's obvious that they use it as a bait or as an excuse. It doesn't matter if the land is by land or by sea. They feel unpunished. They feel themselves immune since the international community continues without taking definitive steps in the face of a genocide that is already surpassing the one they used it as a parapet of the Nazis in the Second World War.
Well, Chema, what we saw was definitely something horrific, especially the scenes in the Rashid Street and what followed, because we had more than one flower massacre in the northern part of Gaza. because of Zionist Israel and what they say that they are trying to do, when the reality is they are trying to take out as many Palestinians as possible, we see that the danger is now growing. And we see that danger growing while we are approaching the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. And Ramadan is not only known for its sanctity as a month where Muslims fast and do prayers to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but usually in Palestine in specific, the intensity of the struggle of the Palestinian people escalates during the month of Palestine. Not only in Gaza, we have seen over the years in the West Bank, in Al-Quds, where people try to get to the Al-Aqsa Mosque to pray in Ramadan, but the Zionist entity doesn't allow them. So go figure what would happen this year when the genocide against the people of Gaza is still ongoing. But what really hits me is that despite the despair, the chaos, the pain that is found in Gaza, is that only limited to the holy month of Ramadan? Is despair of the Gaza residents only linked to Ramadan? I mean, if they stop this, if they do a ceasefire in Ramadan, does it mean that it's okay for them to continue after the holy month of Ramadan and keep killing the Palestinians?
Well, I really don't think the Zionists respect any Ramadan or any situation they could approach to a worse conditions for the people of Gaza. The desperation inside obviously grows, because even like any seriously injured human being, time always runs against the people, no? And at this moment, the possibilities of this genocide claiming more and more lives grows algorithmically as the days goes by. But also, we should not see the situation separately from the global international situation of total war, because Israel continues to be a tool of the empire, a Zionist base at the crossroads of the terrorists, a crossroads of the territories ideal for controlling Asia, Africa, and Europe. The war is also becoming more pronounced in Europe now, and we see the obvious intention coming to unleash a war, a clash against the anti-imperialist bloc in Europe as well. For this reason, we must not stop making a permanent analysis of the global situation to situate this situation in the global situation and understand that the war has more fronts, and not only in Palestine, although Palestine is the center of the war now. But for this reason, maybe all the pressure of the people all around the world make an easier situation for Palestinian people, for Gaza people. But at the same time, this tool, the Zionists, maybe go crazy and go ahead, and then I'm sorry, but I'm sure the Ramadan will be not a stop for them now. Mm-hmm.
Well, Chema, inside of the Zionist entity, we see that Netanyahu, the prime minister of the Israeli entity, is currently finding himself in such a corner under significant international pressure to stop the genocide against the people of the Gaza Strip, and also with pressure coming from inside the Zionist entity itself. But, I mean, as a Lebanese woman, Chema, we know in Lebanon for sure that nothing really can maintain a ceasefire or a halting or a cessation of violence, acts, aggression from the Zionist entity, except one equation, which is a military deterrence equation against the Zionist entity. Nothing else can work. We have tried this before. So who's to say that the Israeli entity won't just continue to hold the card of starvation against the people of Gaza to ensure that, for example, Hamas doesn't take over again the northern part, at least the northern part of Gaza, in the event of a ceasefire? Who's to say they won't just continue with the killing?
I totally agree with you. Yes, they have no other pressure, really pressure, than the military pressure, the military operations of the resistance. And then at the same time, I think we all are hoping for more people, Arab people and anti-imperialist people summing up to the resistance and making this equation a total loss for the Israel and for Zionists. I think it's important to see that the main character of this equation is not Netanyahu. Netanyahu is no more than the other, no more aggressive than the other of the people in Israel. They are all the same. They are a cancer. They are a disease. They are really a curse for all the people in the world, and then they must disappear, totally disappear, and this only has no representative man like Netanyahu. They have a representative entity like the imperialism, like the United States. Israel, Netanyahu are nothing without United States and Europe. And Europe and the United States are now really pressure for genocide. For genocide continues in Gaza, and then they are the real guilty of the equation. Israel is just the cancer, the center of the cancer, but they are not the actor, the main actor. And Netanyahu is only what the United States of America wants to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chema, thank you for explaining how much of a tool Zionist Israel is in the hands of the imperialist United States of America and Europe for that matter. Chema Sanchez, leader of the anti-imperialistas.com group, member of the Red Network for the Defense for Humanity, and also self-proclaimed anti-imperialist militant. Thank you for being with us. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned because next we are going to talk about Netanyahu's plan for the day after the war on Gaza.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Although Zionist Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plan for the day after the war is filled with generalities and cannot form the basis of a real plan, maintaining Israeli entity security after the major shock caused by the Al-Aqsa flood has become the primary impetus for Netanyahu to implement his plan. Now, it is of paramount importance to understand the true motivations behind Netanyahu's presentation of this plan, as this serves as a true gateway to comprehending the actual contents of his plan. More details in the following report.
Israeli entity Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu presented his plan last week before the Zionist War Cabinet for the day after the war in Gaza, based on three time frames. First, the short-term phase, where Netanyahu emphasized the immediate transition to post-war conditions, contingent upon achieving all the war's objectives, which he sees as a prerequisite for entering this phase. Second, medium-term phase, Netanyahu wants the Israeli occupation forces to retrain freedom of military and security action within the Gaza Strip by establishing a security buffer zone along the eastern and northern borders, adjacent to the Gaza Envelope settlements, extending at least 1 kilometer into Gaza's territory. This includes control over the Egyptian-Palestinian borders and the Rafah crossing. Regarding governance and civilian life in Gaza, Netanyahu's plan proposes establishing a civil administration and authority in Gaza under the responsibility of local figures with administrative experience, under Arab or international supervision, not affiliated with the Palestinian resistance factions or the Palestinian Authority. In this phase, the plan includes closing the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, and replacing it with other international relief organizations that Zionist Israel approves of. Additionally, a plan to combat what Netanyahu called Palestinian extremism is proposed in all educational and religious institutions in the Gaza Strip. The reconstruction of Gaza will be conditional upon the disarmament of the Gaza Strip and the commencement of a campaign against extremism according to Israeli entity standards. For Netanyahu's long-term phase, he outlined two fundamental pillars. Firstly, Zionist Israel rejects any dictates from the international community regarding a final solution with the Palestinians, insisting that direct negotiations between the two parties without preconditions are the only way to achieve a final solution. Secondly, Zionist Israel refuses to unilaterally recognize the establishment of a Palestinian state by the international community. Understanding the true motives behind Netanyahu's plan is crucial for grasping its actual content. Netanyahu seems to have written this failure of a plan to appease the Americans, but its content is aimed at not angering Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. Above all this is undoubtedly Netanyahu's personal political interest in avoiding responsibility for the failure of handling the October 7th Al-Aqsa flood operation and continuing in his role as prime minister. Therefore, many in Zionist Israel see Netanyahu's plan as nothing new, but rather a compilation of his statements throughout the Gaza war, continuing the right-wing ideological line based on the idea that reaching a final solution to the conflict with the Palestinians is not beneficial for the Israeli occupation. Thus, his plan continues to pursue a strategy of conflict management by creating facts on the ground to prevent access to a long-term conflict resolution, which Netanyahu views as in Zionist Israel's supreme interest.
Now to discuss this issue with us, Mr. Patrick Henningsen, independent journalist, geopolitical analyst, host of Sunday Wire radio show. And thank you very, very much for your time, Patrick, for being with us. Now, it seems that Netanyahu has in his short, medium and long-term phases looking at reoccupying the Gaza Strip and taking over also the Egyptian-Palestinian borders while installing some sort of a puppet authority similar maybe to the Palestinian authority in the West Bank. That sounds to me like launching a new war all over again in Gaza. What is your take on that?
Well, it's pretty clear, Marwa. This has the full backing of the United States of America. This has been in the works, carefully planned behind the scenes, away from public view. So you have the situation where you have this rhetoric in the public domain from Tony Blinken, from the U.S. State Department, from the President of the United States himself, plus the United Kingdom, the European Union, all talking about some kind of a peaceful solution, some sort of sustainable ceasefire. All the while, they all know very well, full well, of what's going to come. And what's going to come is a plan to is basically establish, as you said, some sort of security zone. We know Israel likes its buffer zones. Of course, the people in Lebanon know this all too well, and tragically too. So what we're also seeing here is the fast tracking of settlements, of putting new people on the ground there to change facts on the ground. This process will also begin. But best laid plans of mice and men, Marwa, unfortunately, it may not work to plan. The situation is very different now than it has been in the past, and they're going to come up against heavy resistance, heavy friction. And this is the thing that they fail to calculate time and time again, especially the Israelis' backers in Washington just completely underestimate the axis of resistance. And they've been doing it consistently. And the results are you have a quagmire here that Israel will probably not be able to manage, nor will the United States, who is backing it.
Well, Patrick, during the stage, especially the medium-term stage, Netanyahu's strategy entails shutting down the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as the UNRWA, and substituting it with what he said are alternative international relief organizations, obviously endorsed by Zionist Israel. Now, is that a decision even within the jurisdiction of the Zionist entity to implement? I mean, the UNRWA is, at the end of the day, a UN body. Who's to say that Netanyahu wants simply incarcerate or even kill the UNRWA employees to scare off any form of working with them or dealing with them on the ground in Gaza?
This is the same sort of problem. You have the Israelis working in a sort of area of fantasy land, of non-reality. The UN Relief and Works Agency scandal that Israel accused it of being, you know, infiltrated by Hamas has been completely debunked many times over, and for weeks now, for over a month now. So there's no basis to those accusations to begin with, but you can see the agenda, and I think you see it all too well, that the United States, Israel, they would like to replace the people in key positions. They want to get their own sort of operatives into place on the ground in Gaza. They want to get U.S. agents into place, Western agents into place, people who are allied with the Zionist entity, as it were, into position there. Because as you can see from South Africa's ICJ genocide case, UNRWA was very instrumental in providing the actual data, the actual evidence which implicated Israel in genocide. So they're very upset about this. And of course, from that point on, They basically were on a tirade to try to destroy this UNHC. So it is out of their jurisdiction completely, but they're going to press really hard on this because this is about being able to change facts on the ground, to change the narrative on the ground. You do so by replacing the agencies that used to be responsible for providing aid and relief, and then changing all of the staff, changing all of the people in key positions. And basically, by doing that, they can totally transform the story in the eyes of the international community and the UN.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know how much they can actually implement such a thing inside of Gaza when the entire population of Gaza is well aware of any foreign agents that could very much try to probably lurk themselves into the societies and the communities of the people of Gaza, especially after the genocide, Patrick. But Netanyahu, in that plan as well, which is basically just audacious of him to put it pen to paper, but he also blatantly proposed a plan to combat what he referred to as Palestinian extremism, wow, in all educational and religious institutions in the Gaza Strip, putting this step as a precondition for the reconstruction of Gaza. Look at that evil mind there. But don't worry about that. What does he suggest here Zionists do about this? I mean, do they want to install imams in the mosques? Do they want to rewrite history just as they did in the West, for example, especially the Palestinian history, change the academic curriculum for the Palestinians? How is that not an extension of the human genocide? This is a cultural genocide.
So this is just, again, more of the same, changing reality, transforming the narrative. They want to de-radicalize, essentially what they're proposing, to de-radicalize an anti-apartheid armed liberation struggle. We've had those throughout history in many different countries, in many different situations, and you cannot erase them, unfortunately, for the occupiers, unfortunately for colonial oppressors in history. You cannot erase these things. They will persist. So long as the oppression persists, so will the resistance. And we will remind people that the United Nations and international law recognizes the right to an armed resistance for liberation. They have in South Africa, where these people were demonized for decades for resisting apartheid. And now, look, Nelson Mandela is regarded as a hero, winning the Nobel Peace Prize, and the ANC is in power in South Africa right now. You could very well see the same thing in this situation in the future. So again, they're just tinkering with reality, and it was really doomed to fail because it ignores the real fundamental problems that gave us this crisis to begin with.
Mm-hmm. We just have one more minute, Patrick, before we end off this segment, and I want to ask you about the real deal with the upcoming proposed ceasefire. Do you think that the Zionist entity will actually approve of any of the points put forth by the resistance? Because Hamas has been very adamant on taking what it should to prevent any further calamity for the Palestinians. Do you think that the Zionist entity will go ahead and begin a ceasefire?
This is classic Israeli negotiation tactics, which everybody knows all too well, is to create an impossible situation where the other side, in this case, Hamas, could never agree to terms, and just to carry on trying to implement and execute their agenda. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to stop doing that. And so the ceasefire will become theater to buy time for Israel to change facts on the ground in their favor, unfortunately. That's what it looks like to us.
Well, Patrick Henningsen, independent journalist, geopolitical analyst, thanks a million for joining us to discuss this pressing issue, especially in the genocided and killed, maimed, betrayed Gaza Strip. As we speak, ladies and gents, thank you very much for joining us right here on the Mideast stream. Please keep in mind that we will always remain the voice of the voiceless. We'll see you again next week on the Mideast stream. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The co-founders of the Truth Social platform are suing Donald Trump, claiming that Trump tried to dilute their shares. A lawyer representing the co-founders of Truth Social said, "They created Truth Social and now the beneficiary of that, Donald Trump, doesn't want to pay." We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Huffington Post has covered this story and tells us more. An estimated $4 billion business merger involving former President Donald Trump's social media company could hit a major snarl after a lawsuit was filed on Wednesday, 28th of February, accusing Donald Trump of trying to dilute the co-founder's shares. Andy Lutinsky and Wes Moss, who co-founded Trump's Truth Social platform, filed the lawsuit in Delaware, claiming their previously negotiated 8.6% stake in Trump Media and Technology Group has been watered down to less than 1%, the Washington Post and CNBC have reported. The dispute comes as the Trump Media and Technology Group eyes a merger with the publicly traded shell company Digital World Acquisition Corp. The sale, which Digital World's shareholders are scheduled to vote on next month, is estimated to be worth as much as $4 billion, according to the New York Times. The attempt here is to deprive them of the deal, attorney Christopher Clark, who is representing Andy Lutinsky and Wes Moss, partnership United Atlantic Ventures, in the complaint, told CNBC News. They actually went out and did the work. They created the Truth Social platform, and now the beneficiary of that, Donald Trump, doesn't want to pay. Christopher Clark and representatives of Donald Trump, Digital World, and the Trump Media and Technology Group did not immediately respond to Huffington Post's request for comment. Under the United Atlantic Ventures previously reached agreement, Donald Trump would receive 78 million shares that are worth about $3.5 billion at today's share price value. United Atlantic Ventures would receive more than 7 million shares, equating to roughly $339 million, according to the Washington Post review of a court motion requesting expedited proceedings in the case. Digital World appeared to recognize that previous deal with United Atlantic Ventures in a Securities and Exchange Commission filing early this month, but said that the agreement was declared void by a Trump attorney more than 2 years ago. The sale of any stock could come as a major financial lifeline to Donald Trump, who has faced numerous legal judgments against him since leaving Oval Office, including an order earlier this month to pay $355 million plus interest for committing business fraud in New York State. An appeals court judge on Wednesday denied Trump's request to pause that judgment's enforcement. Trump, currently the frontrunner for the Republican presidential nomination, argued that he doesn't have the cash to cover the penalty. This isn't the first time that a founder of Trump's Truth Social platform has spoken out against him while alleging misconduct, particularly involving stocks. Will Wilkerson, who helped found the Trump Media and Technology Group, but was then fired after speaking out about alleged security law violations, alleged in 2022 that Donald Trump asked Andy Lutinsky to relinquish his stock in the company to his wife, Melania Trump. Will Wilkerson also said that Trump's sons, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump, requested a financial stake in the social media platform despite having never worked for the company. They were coming in and asking for a handout, Wilkerson told the Washington Post. They had no bearing in this company, and they were taking equity away from hardworking individuals. National broadcaster CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump was accused in a lawsuit on Wednesday, 28th of February, of trying to drastically dilute the value of stock shares in his social media company, held by the firm's co-founders, potentially depriving them of hundreds of millions of dollars in profits. The partnership United Atlantic Ventures alleges that Donald Trump's media and technology group engaged in wrongful 11th-hour maneuvering to dilute United Atlantic Ventures' minority stake in the media company, according to a court filing. The Delaware Chancery Court lawsuit comes in advance of the planned merger of TMTG, the Trump media and technology group, with a shell company called Digital World Acquisition Corp., which would result in the shares of the combined entity being publicly traded. If the Digital World Acquisition Corp. shareholders approve the merger next month, Trump's 90% stake in the Trump Media and Technology Group could be valued at more than $3 billion, given the Digital World Acquisition Corp.'s current share price. On Thursday, an investment vehicle controlled by former Digital World Acquisition Corp. chairman and chief executive officer Patrick Orlando sued in Chancery Court to block the merger unless it receives a larger number of shares from the combination that Digital World Acquisition Corp. proposes, according to a Reuters news agency report. The news service noted that the Trump Media and Technology Group and the Digital World Acquisition Corp. on Tuesday sued Orlando and his ARK Global Investments II vehicle in Florida, claiming that he's trying to obtain a windfall by extortion. United Atlantic Ventures is a partnership of Andy Litinsky and Wes Moss, who initially pitched Trump the idea of creating Trump Media in February of 2021. After the former president was banned from Twitter and Facebook following the deadly 6th of January 2021 Capitol riot. Both Andy Litinsky and Wes Moss were contestants on Trump's television show The Apprentice. The Trump Media and Technology Group later built and launched Truth Social, the social media platform that Donald Trump uses almost exclusively to communicate with the public. The planned merger comes as Trump, who is leading candidate for the Republican presidential nomination, has been ordered to pay more than $500 million in civil judgments in New York related to trial verdicts for business fraud and the defamation of writer E. Jean Carroll. The attempt here is to deprive them of the deal, said Christopher Clark, the lawyer for United Atlantic Ventures in the partnership's Delaware lawsuit against the Trump Media and Technology Group. It's not like they went out and bought a lottery ticket, Clark said of the co-founders. They actually went out and did the work. They created the Truth Social platform, and now the beneficiary of that, Donald Trump, doesn't want to pay. Not a unique story, unfortunately, Christopher Clark said, referring to Trump's infamous practice of contesting bills from contractors and lawyers. CNBC has requested comment from a spokesperson for Donald Trump. CNBC has requested comment from a spokesman for Donald Trump, as well as the Trump Media and Technology Group.
face to face. Hello and welcome to another edition of Face to Face. I'm Matt Yapusyan. Today in the studio, we are joined by one of the members of the political bureau of the Hamas resistance movement, Mr. Osama Hamdan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Hamdan, the Al-Aqsa flood was a powerful, unexpected blow to the Israeli occupation. But did you anticipate the Israeli response to be this much brutal and heinous?
There is no doubt that Operation Al-Aqsa Flood represented a success for the resistance movement, a success in carrying out a large-scale operation without the enemy being able to take action preemptively. This operation succeeded in seizing the entire Gaza positions within just hours. This is undoubtedly a great achievement, but here's the question. Was there any expectation for the enemy's reaction? Certainly. It was expected that there would be a reaction, but it is the nature of the occupation. It kills you, seizes your land, arrests you, and imprisons you. For example, in the West Bank in 2022, before the operations, the number of martyrs was about 500. The number of wounded people who were taken to hospitals exceeded 3,000. We are talking about thousands of prisoners. Under this occupation for 75 years, you have two choices. Either you do nothing and it continues to kill you, capture you, and seize your land, or you resist and the enemy will continue the aggression. But the message will be conveyed that the Palestinian people are still adhering to their right to resist, that the enemy is paying a price for the occupation, and that in the end, this enemy will be forced to leave your land. Therefore, when you always choose resistance and you anticipate the scale of aggression and the enemy's reaction, you are convinced that this is the path that will lead to liberation.
With all the killing, destruction in Gaza, backed by the West, especially the United States, how do you plan to rebuild your popularity and also lay foundations for a new phase?
First, we start with the fact that the United States of America does not just support Israel. The United States of America is a partner in crime, a partner in genocide. It may appear to support Israel politically, but in practice, it provides ammunition, equipment, and weapons to the Zionist entity. It also employs all technological facilities in discovering tunnels and thus serves as pillars of Zionism. It is a full partner in the crime against the Palestinian people. On the other hand, when we talk about our popularity, we are not worried about it because historically the Palestinian people have always been the ones who choose resistance, and the popularity of resistance always rises. 2 months ago, various opinion polling institutions conducted an opinion poll about the popularity of the Palestinian Authority. Hamas is popular in Gaza, which was not so before the operation. Before the war, Hamas's popularity ranged between 40 to 45%. After the operation, its popularity rose. The Palestinian people saw that the resistance movement has been fighting this army for days, an army that boasted about its invincibility. People began to feel that the chances of liberation were higher than ever before, so Hamas's popularity rose. This gives us additional responsibility. How do we deal with this popularity, and what serves the interest of our people to achieve national success? There is no doubt that this is a great responsibility.
Definitely it is. Now, there are propositions suggesting that Hamas is being coerced into relinquishing its leadership role in Gaza post-war amidst American and possibly Arab support, now leading to a transition to the Palestinian Authority. Now, what is Hamas's stance on these propositions, and how do you plan to particularly thwart them?
Firstly, it is clear that Hamas was never committed to being the ruling authority. We have always adhered to a specific principle that the Palestinian people are the ones who elect and who choose their leadership through free elections. The leadership must present a program to the people that hold it accountable. Our program is clear. We resist for liberation. We won the election in 2006 and served this platform. America cannot change this fact, and we do not accept its interference in our internal affairs. We have informed all Arab countries that their interference over the Palestinian people is rejected. Whoever decides the next day in Gaza or the Palestinian people alone. This is the first part. The second part. We met with all the Palestinian factions and an agreement was reached on basic issues, including the formation of a transitional Palestinian government after the war in which all the factions are represented and have their authority to hold elections and begin the reconstruction process. Therefore, we are not concerned about the future of the leadership of the Palestinian people as much as we are keen for the leadership to be the one that has the option of resistance and believes in the complete liberation of Palestine.
The next question is, your objective with Operation Al-Aqsa was to shed light on the plight of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, yet the occupation has added around 10,000 new prisoners. Does Hamas still prioritize shedding light on prisoners, or is it the priority now to reach a ceasefire and to get humanitarian aid into Gaza?
Let me clarify here that the issue of prisoners was just part of the objectives of the operation and was not the primary objective of it. The main goal of the operation was to confront the project of the Netanyahu government, which announced that it would end the Palestinian issue within the next 4 years. He developed a program to seize Al-Quds and transfer ownership of real estate from the Palestinians to the Zionists, seizing the maximum level, building more settlements in the West Bank, and developed a program to bring in 1 million new settlers from outside of Palestine, Jews from all over the world, and decided to begin the process of rebuilding his relations in the region, with American support, to form a situation in which Israel appears to be a natural entity. The operation came to say that Palestine is still under occupation. The Palestinian people are still resistant. We want to liberate our land, and this is what happened. One of the results of the operation is that the prisoners will be transferred. One of the results of the operation is that the siege on the Palestinian people ends. But the essence of the process is to put the Palestinian issue on the right path.
Great. Now, if a ceasefire is agreed upon, what kind of a guarantee can there be that ensures the U.S. will comply with the terms, or the Israeli regime for that matter, especially if and when all the captives are released? Because we know when it comes to Israelis, they are not very good with being committed to their oaths and their commitments.
I agree with you that the Israelis do not abide by agreements and covenants. Their history of this is very bad. Therefore, the real guarantee is the resistance's ability to continue the confrontation with the occupation. The real guarantee is the ability of the Palestinian people to withstand. The real guarantee that we won in Operation Al-Aqsa Flood is that the Israelis and Americans began to realize that the resistance axis is capable of applying pressure to support the resistance in Gaza and is capable of having an effective influence on the political positions in favor of the resistance. Therefore, when you make an agreement, you bet on the power cards you hold, that they are the ones that can be a true guarantor of the agreement that was concluded. The occupation will try to evade or deceive, but we will also try, through the power cards we possess, to make it as disciplined as possible.
And Mr. Hamdan, speaking of negotiations and ceasefire talks, why did Hamas withdraw from the Cairo negotiations? Does the delay harm Palestinians more or the occupation?
The truth is that we did not withdraw from the Cairo negotiations. What happened was that after the Paris meeting, a proposal was presented to Hamas regarding a ceasefire and some details. This proposal was also presented to the occupation side. For us, we responded to the proposal. We proposed some modifications to it and developed our vision to improve the proposal. On the Israeli side, the mediators were surprised because Israel, which had expressed its approval of the Paris proposal, retracted parts of it. Therefore, the mediators began trying to bring Israel back to the Paris proposal. We must wait for the reaction of the mediators with the Zionist entity. From our side, there was a clear statement by our brother Ismail Haniya, head of the political bureau, that we deal positively with ideas that we are keen to stop the aggression, provide relief to our people and the people of the siege, and the start of reconstruction process. In exchange for all of this, we will go to the prisoner exchange process, and therefore we have clearly defined our position. We are waiting for the enemy to have a positive position. The ball is in their court and the mediator's court. We have not backed down. As long as we are negotiating, we go on with it, and as long as the fight goes on, we fight.
Mr. Hamdan, how can Hamas utilize internal pressure on Netanyahu by emphasizing the urgency of releasing prisoners in Gaza, by highlighting the significance of this issue within Israeli society and among political stakeholders? This heightened pressure may compel him to seek a ceasefire deal that aligns with Hamas's terms in order to de-escalate tensions and address the issue of prisoners effectively.
There is no doubt that in the negotiation process, you make every effort to put pressure on the enemy. One of the tools of pressure, which you also mentioned, is to the prisoner swap, what these prisoners are suffering from, and the killing that occurred to some families as a result of the Israeli Air Force's bombing of some sites. Also, some of the prisoners were killed directly by the occupation army, as happening with three soldiers who were captured by the resistance, and then the group that captured them was martyred. When they escaped, the army killed them despite identifying them. This puts great pressure on Netanyahu, but the resistance also has other tools to put pressure on Netanyahu. One of them is the resistance's unrelenting firing of rockets at some cities and regions occupied in 1948. The continuation of the resistance action on the battlefield against the occupation is putting pressure on Israel, because every day there are more deaths among the occupation soldiers and more losses among the files and ranks of the army. Just for the army, the destruction of 1,000 military vehicles out of about 4,000 military vehicles in the ground forces is very heavy. This is all a lot of pressure on Netanyahu. An important addition that should be noted is the action of the resistance in southern Lebanon, or what the Ansarullah resistance is doing in Yemen, or the resistance in Iraq. This created pressure on the Zionist entity and also on the United States, which does not want the confrontation to expand in the region because it still believes that it can rearrange the region. The expansion of the confrontation will cause the Americans to lose control in the region, and the region will go on paths that will not necessarily be in the interest of the Americans, but rather will be in the interest of the people of the region. And this is what the Americans fear. These are all pressure cards on Netanyahu, and I believe this is the secret of the American insistence on reaching a solution that leads to a ceasefire.
Now, something about a ceasefire. Right now, the situation in Rafah. Netanyahu threatens to invade Rafah, even if a ceasefire agreement is reached. How can Hamas, you know, restrain Netanyahu's recklessness in his military options in Gaza?
When Netanyahu threatens to invade Rafah, he is seeking two purposes. The first goal is to create pressure on the resistance to give up some of its demands in the negotiations. The second one is to try to put pressure on the mediators, otherwise things will deteriorate further. We said to the mediators that any move Netanyahu makes to attack Rafah will be faced by the resistance, but it will also make Netanyahu involved in a genocide massacre. And everyone knows that the International Court of Justice issued a preliminary ruling and set conditions for it. If Netanyahu is involved in a military operation towards Rafah, this will confirm that what he is doing is genocide, and this means that he is committing a crime against humanity, and this will have repercussions not only for him, but also on the American administration, which I mentioned a little while ago that it is an accomplice in this crime. That's why we're applying confrontational pressure. I think that Netanyahu is hesitant about the Grand Operation, but if he decides to do so, things will not be easy for his army.
Now, the world sympathizes greatly with the Palestinian people, but Israelis are attempting to influence global attention. For example, by, you know, Israeli president presentation of a book titled The End of the Jews to convince the world that Hamas seeks to annihilate the Jewish population. Now, how do you respond to such displays, especially in a significant security conference like the Munich conference?
I must clarify an issue by which the Israelis and the United States are trying to put pressure on us. We do not fight the Israelis because they are Jews. We are fighting them because they are occupiers of our land. Meaning if they leave our land, we will not pursue them and we will not fight them. Our battle has a political dimension that has nothing to do with the fact that they are Jews and believe in Judaism and has nothing to do with the fact that they came to Palestine or are present in other places. The real problem is that they occupied our land. The Jewish problem as a religious one is not related to our country. Rather, the Jewish problem began in Europe. They were expelled from Britain in the 16th century, and for 200 years, Jews were banned from entering. In France, they were prevented from exercising their religious rights from 1400 AD until 1808. In Spain, they were expelled and prevented from exercising their religious rights until 1982. In Germany, we know what happened. Every time the Jews fled this persecution, they came to our Muslim country. And you know that there are Jews in all Muslim countries who live in safety. The problem rose when they decided to become an occupying force, usurp our rights, and kill our people, which prompted us to resist them. Therefore, when the Zionist chief of staff talks about the end of the Jews, he is lying and trying to make excuses for a story that we did not create and was created by the Nazis. I think the answer to it is very simple. The Zionist media published pictures of him signing the missiles that were fired to kill our people, women and children. Therefore, I hope that he changes the title of his book to say, The End of the Occupation. Yes, the occupation will end, and we as Muslims will certainly be able to end it. This is our religion to embrace all people of other religions. As Palestinians, we have Muslims and Christians. No one has ever talked about a crisis between Muslims and Christians in Palestine. Rather, we lived as one nation. Therefore, yes, the occupation will end, but not on the basis that the head of the Zionist entity or the Zionist propaganda speaks about. They want to make us appear as brutal people.
Thank you. That was a very thorough explanation of the conflict between Palestinians and the Israeli regime. Now, let's talk about what's going to happen after the genocidal war in Gaza. How do you envision the end of this onslaught and now entering its fifth month without a clear ceasefire on the horizon?
There is no doubt that the occupation announced the goals of its military operation. They announced that they want to destroy the resistance of Hamas. They want to destroy Hamas, meaning the resistance. They announced that they wanted to free the prisoners from the hands of the resistance. They announced that they wanted to form an administration for the Gaza Strip, an administration linked to the regime. After about 5 months, what happened? They failed to eliminate the resistance. The resistance on the battlefield is still fighting. Every day there are losses among the occupation army, dead and wounded. They are still held captive by the resistance. The enemy was unable to free anyone alive except for what took place according to the exchange we agreed upon. They failed in trying to create a situation in which an administration in Gaza works with the occupation. They once spoke about clans and families, and the families issued a statement saying that they were biased towards the resistance. They tried to talk about a civil administration to be imposed on the Palestinian people. The Palestinians announced that they would deal with it as agents of the regime. Therefore, they failed in all of their goals. They had only one thing left, and that was the attack on Rafah. Its results will also be a failure. The enemy will realize at some point that it is unable to succeed. The Americans realize this issue and therefore are trying to persuade the Israelis to accept a ceasefire. The regional countries that accepted the Israeli aggression began to realize that the resistance's victory would not serve the interest of the Zionists. Therefore, I believe that the chances of reaching a ceasefire agreement, even if they do not seem high so far, are now present, and we will do our best to achieve it as quickly as possible, God willing.
And Mr. Hamdan, you already mentioned the support for the Palestinian resistance by the Iraqi resistance, the resistance in Yemen and Lebanon. Now, I want to ask you, how does Hamas evaluate this support for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip? Have they, slowed down the pace of the onslaught in Gaza or exerted significant pressure on Israel and Americans that support them or are complicit in their crimes to impose certain options on Netanyahu?
I think there were two impacts. There is a direct impact and there is a strategic impact. The direct impact of the Resistance Act in Lebanon forced the occupation regime to keep parts of the army in northern Palestine. This means that if this confrontation had not occurred, this entire army would have launched an aggression against Gaza, and therefore the Israeli army's ability to confront it in Gaza would have been exhausted. Also, the resistance in Lebanon succeeded in inflicting real losses and casualties on the occupation army, and the occupation army began to feel that it might fall into additional trouble if this aggression continued. The resistance in Yemen succeeded in sending a clear message. A siege on the Palestinian people means a siege on the Zionist entity. The American administration did not succeed in dealing with the matter despite its aggression against Yemen. It has been proven that this aggression did not lead to any cessation of the resistance in Yemen, represented by our brothers in Ansar Allah. In Iraq, the American administration thought that the Iraqi people, after everything they had gone through and suffered from the American occupation and the injustice they suffered, might not care about issues like the Palestinian issue. The Americans were surprised that the Iraqi people began their resistance to confirm that they were with Palestine, and thus the Americans seemed to realize that they were losing and that their losses would be reflected in Israel. Strategically, I believe that the resistance action in Lebanon, Yemen, and Iraq achieved two goals. The first is that it sent a message that the resistance in the region is cohesive and works together in its own way and not according to what others want. Its method is effective. The second issue is that this axis has a firm, principled position and is using its capabilities in an intelligent and wise manner and is capable of achieving results. This means that the future of the region will not be according to what the United States of America or the Zionist entity wants. Rather, we are approaching a stage that the future of the region will be according to what the people of the region want. Therefore, I believe that what was achieved strategically and momentarily was important.
Okay, and the next thing I want to ask you, Mr. Hamdan, is about reports that suggest that Hamas, a political bureau chief, Ismail Haniyeh, and leader of Hamas in the Gaza Strip have lost contact. What is the situation now between the two? Has contact been reestablished? Or the other thing that I want to know, is there a disagreement between the two when it comes to a ceasefire?
Let me answer the second question, which is the consensus on a ceasefire. There is agreement on all the basic issues, whether between Brother Ismail Haniyeh, Brother Yahya Sinwar, or even within the political bureau of the movement. Most of the talk about internal division is rumors spread by the Zionist occupation forces.